Okay.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Sorry.
Before we start talking about FICE, just a quick admin point. So following on from admin discussion yesterday and consulting everybody's diaries, we plan to move the July ASAF meeting to the 6th and the 7th of July, which I think works for everybody based on yesterday's conversations, and also works for Han. So 6th and 7th of July, and we'll update the public website to reflect that. Okay, with no further ado, we'll hand over to Team FICE.
FICE squad.
There's nothing like the smell of FICE in the morning. That's how the saying goes.
FICE on thin ice.
Oh my god.
Early forward humour.
Humour coffee.
Dinner must have been good last night.
I just wanted to start by making a few remarks about the status of the project. I know we've been through the whole update of where we are at the December meeting, so I'm not going to repeat that. I just wanted to say that the board has completed a substantial part of its deliberations to date. So we only really have a couple of issues that the board is going to be debating, which we plan to bring to the board in March, which we hope then will finish the technical deliberations on the project. After that, following that, depending on the board's workload, publication schedule, etc., we do think that it might be possible for us to publish sometime in the fourth quarter of this year. So in this session, the purpose of this session is really just to give you a better feel for some of the practical implications of what's going to be proposed in the discussion paper. We have illustrated some of those practical implications just using some simple examples of instruments where or claims where there might be either a change in classification as a result of the board's work or presentation compared to IS 32, or perhaps also some areas where there's currently diversity in practice, and we think some of the clarifications that the board's discussed might help address some of those issues and help people apply the distinction between liabilities and equity. As we set out in sort of slides 2 and 3, the board has already made a lot of these decisions, so we're not really looking on feedback on what the board's on the board's decision making. We are, of course, going to be looking for your feedback when we're doing the consultation following publication of the discussion paper. But in slide 3, we really just summarize a couple of questions, but feel free to make other remarks. What we're looking at is whether the examples really demonstrate some of those practical implications that we're going to talk about, and whether you have any other suggestions that might help us make some of these examples more useful, or even if you have some other examples that come to mind that you think might be better representations of some of those practical implications. Slides 4 and 5, I'm just going to touch on these, just some of the practical implications. I already touched on them slightly. I'm not going to go through the detail of the underlying rationale of the model that's going to be proposed in the discussion paper. All I want to highlight really is just that there are practical implications that might come through classification. Now, the board has debated a lot about the underlying rationale of the classification, but we don't really expect there to be too many changes arising from refining that underlying rationale compared to IS 32 today. That's why there have been a lot of conceptual type of foundational debates, but we're not really that isn't really going to automatically result in very big shifts in the classification outcomes compared to 32. There is going to be some changes around the boundaries because of those clarifications, but they're not going to be major. So there is going to be one practical implication coming out, slight practical implications coming out of that work. Perhaps the more interesting implications in terms of the projects are going to come through the separate presentation requirements and the proposed additional disclosure requirements as well. And that's where we think entities might have to do a bit more work. There might be some more presentation provided in terms of the balance sheet, in terms of the statement of financial performance, both for liabilities and for potentially for equity instruments, depending on feedback that we get on the attribution requirements. And finally, the board did, as I mentioned, the board did discuss a lot of additional guidance that will help people apply the requirements for the classification and presentation proposals. At the moment, IS32 doesn't really have that much additional guidance to help in the application, so we're looking to develop some additional application guidance and some illustrative examples, and the board discussed these in February, in particular for written put. Because at the moment, IS32 only really has, you know, one paragraph on written puts, and then it's quite open. So we've tried to fill some of those applications. So what I plan to do is just run through the examples one by one. But before I start, does anyone have any questions or comments?
Andrew?
Is it part of the plan before publication of the discussion paper to look at some of the measurement issues that I'll describe as consequential partly on the existing equity guidance and partly on some aspects of what's been developed here? For example, on the measurement issue on contingently convertible instruments that was considered to be too broad for the IFRIC to address, and perhaps if one of the consequences, one of the areas that classification may change under this model is certain types of claim that are mandatorily settled only on liquidation. That raises to me a fairly clear question about how to measure something that is going to be settled at an unspecified future date that might be never. So, any plans to talk about measurement?
We try to focus this project on classification and presentation questions. Part of that is because we try to limit any potential amendments that we might be making to IFRS 9, because we've just published that it's going to become effective soon, so we don't really want to tinker with that too much. So what we've tried to do, for instance, for the contingent convertible bonds, is try to provide additional clarification about when, for instance, you might have an equity component. However, the detailed measurement of any liability and equity component will probably be a matter for IFRS 9. Now,
can I also just ask, Andrew, to clarify, you're talking about COCOs, right? How to measure those. How much of that question, and is it coming from how to measure the fair value of those COCOs, or what are the measures? Because even in practice today, there's quite a bit of debate on what is the actual measurement, how do you measure a COCO? Or are you talking about the split, which comes up maybe if you have such a thing, and how do you measure the residual on initial recognition? I'm trying to understand how much of the steps, even from IFRS 9 into fair value measurement issues, and how much goes into the splitting issues.
What you're getting at, I presume, is the fact that at the moment the debit would be for the full amount of the liability. So, you know, if in theory it could be triggered tomorrow, it would be the full $100, and therefore it affects the residual. And one of the things we got in the feedback on the mandatory tender offers was questions about the appropriateness of it being the full 100 if the likelihood of exercise was quite low. So should that affect the liability measurement?
Okay, if the settlement, whether it's a liability component or a liability in its entirety, which is also partly a measurement issue, if the settlement is rise to the liability components or feature is contingent, do you take account of the contingency in determining the fair value? I don't think with respect to this an IFRS 9 issue, or it could be, if it's fair value in a normal sense, I think I know what that means, and that would include taking account of the probability of the event happening or not happening. But like I said, it's an example of an issue the Interpretations Committee considered, thought was too broad. The agenda decision referred to FICE project, and I think there's an expectation among stakeholders that the FICE project will come up with an answer.
I think definitely in terms of the classification, we have talked about that, whether there is and some additional guidance about whether there is an equity component, because there was a question about whether it was entirely equity, entirely liability, etc. So I think we've addressed that. We haven't talked about measurement, because we were relying on, once we've identified the components, it will be passed on through IFRS 9. But you had another question about those instruments that are potentially deferrable, payments deferrable until liquidation, I think. So cumulative preference shares.
Or non-cumulative preference shares with a fixed, with a fixed claim on liquidation.
Yeah, exactly. But I, personally, I don't think that IFRS 9 will really struggle to measure those. I think it's probably
it's
going
a perpetuity. It will be priced as a perpetuity.
What if it's a non-cumulative preference share, but there is a fixed claim on liquidation amount?
If it's non-cumulative, then it's going to be an equity instrument. If there's only the model will only classify cumulative preference shares as a liability.
Even if the capital is payable on liquidation, if there's no discretion around that.
We're not looking at what's going to be paid at liquidation. I think what we're looking at is what the claim is as a going concern. And if the claim is for a fixed amount as a going concern, then it's going to be a liability. So, for instance, for the non-cumulative preference shares, because it's non-cumulative, there's no fixed claim as a going concern. There's only a fixed claim at liquidation. But if you assume going concern and you discount that back, you essentially get to zero anyway. So that's not a real issue under the...
I can substitute the word preference share in your talk with perpetual bond and reach the same conclusion, isn't it?
Sorry, perpetual bond.
Fixed rate perpetual bond.
The word preference share.
Yes, exactly.
Bond, yeah. Simple
yes, yeah, exactly.
So I think that's a clarification, and Manuel and I have had many hours of fun talking about this. But so even if for the perpetual preference share, the amount due in a liquidation was a fixed $100, which isn't linked to the value of the entity, if it's non-cumulative, because it's only a claim in liquidation, it would be equity classifying.
Yeah.
But it's something we need to be more clear about, because it's not clear from the words.
Get there if you read the words.
I haven't got the words here.
On slide 12.
These are non-redeemable cumulative preference shares.
Yeah, but the example is trying to illustrate the principle. So
yes.
No. Slide 12.
Slide
12. So if we're saying that for a specified amount, independent of the economic resources of the entity, regardless of settlement requirements, so we're saying, let's say it's only at liquidation, but it's for $100.
Something we need to make.
Why isn't that a liability then, based on those words?
Well, sorry, what I was trying to explain was that even if you say that it is a liability, but if you discount it back, you're going to get to zero anyway.
Okay, that's then a measurement.
Yeah. But the point is that the non-cumulative kind of distribution component of that, which is going to be a large part of that, the value of that claim is going to be equity. Because that's not a fixed amount, it's discretionary. It's if the entity doesn't pay it, the obligation goes away.
Talking about just for the coupon, that's not
cumulative. Yes, yeah.
But the capital.
Yeah.
But it's a good point. We should clarify this.
Yeah.
First of all, I agree with the Angel's point that you think about the measurement issues. Another issue I would like to raise, maybe it's not relevant to the classification from issue part, but as I understand it, the board intention is not to make big changes on this project as well as maybe other projects. the issue comes from that currently we are discussing the issue from issues. And it will result in some classification changes because some financial instruments currently classified as equity, but eventually they will classify the liability based on the, our new approach. Maybe, of course, some parts of the changes in value will go to OCI. But when we see comments from Chinese, some Chinese stakeholders, they think this issue from the holder side, because on IFRS 9, if that's the actual instrument, they are allowed to classify this equity investment as fair value through OCI for some insurance companies, something like that. But if those equity instruments will classify to be a date instrument, for those holders, they have to measure those financial instruments they hold as fair value, maybe through P&L. I'm not sure whether they can qualify amortized cost. It's very difficult for them. Right. So that's where a very big change for those holders' financial statements, not simply from those issues side. So I hope that we need to think about both sides. Yesterday we discussed some asymmetrical accounting treatment, but from both sides we need to think about this kind of easy reading.
And I think the intention in the DP is to talk about that interaction, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, so one of the things that we're going to bring to the board in March is just a paper just outlining these interactions, because the definitions are used more than just for classification as liabilities and equity, and the discussion paper is going to just explain that so that people know that and can respond to the consultations, and the board can think about if it does want to go ahead with any changes. It keeps those interactions in mind, definitely.
Absolutely. We'll be flying on the DP.
Andreas.
Thanks. I would also embark on the interface between 32 and IFRS 9, because in IFRS 9, classification is being made on the basis of the definitions that IIS 32. So an equity instrument is defined in 32, but it's defined from the perspective of the issuer, not the holder. And therefore, there have been questions coming to the IFRIC at that point in time, where this means that if the issuer classified an instrument as equity, does that automatically mean that I have, as a holder, an equity instrument? Or could it be something different? And I think this is quite important. Has become quite important in the context of putable instruments, but I'm pretty sure there will be others as well. In terms of Andrew's point and measurement, I couldn't agree more. I think there is something that we have struggled for a long time and that regards putable instruments, but probably also redeemable instruments that are redeemable / putable at a different value than fair value or fixed amount. So you don't qualify for the amendment. All 32 tells you is this is a liability. But how to measure it, if you then come onto IFRS 9, which is not different to 39 then, it tells you, well, it's either held for trading or it's another liability. Well, certainly I don't trade my own liability, so therefore must be other liabilities. The measurement attribute is amortized cost. And the question is, what does amortized cost mean for an instrument with an indefinite life that's redeemable or payable at some undetermined amount, not fair value, not specified amount? Don't know. So you could just analogize to other literature, like the core deposit thing, that it is the amount that could be required to be paid at the earliest point in time, but there's really no straight link between the two. And so this is something that I can just urge you to look into and maybe park to then be picked up in the post-implementation review. You can't solve through 32.
Perhaps. I think that we are trying to keep a pretty focused scope for this project, so we don't get into a lot of these questions would apply to measurement of liabilities absent the issues about classification, I think. So I don't think this project is necessarily the best place to consider a lot of those questions, and that's why we've been trying to stay away from measurement in general.
I accept that. I just want to make sure that this is not dumped. Somehow being followed up.
Yeah. Okay.
I have one further comment that is already relating a bit to your examples, and specifically the first one on foreign currency. We will be coming back to that, and I make my specific comment when we come to it, but the general point is really to be mindful of the relationship to other fields of law, especially financial regulation. Right. So if we say for good reasons that there is a principle, and if you apply that principle, for instance, foreign currency would lead you to liability treatment, that could have significant adverse effects on banks' financial capital, really. And the question is, do we really, quote-unquote, want to say that, where financial regulators are trying to increase banks' capital or make banks increase their capital?
But we're going to be having discussions with the regulators as well, just to keep them informed, and so that they can have the opportunity to take any action that they need to take to, as a result of anything that we eventually finalize. But how they define capital is, I think, for the most part, separated from our definitions of liabilities and equity. There might be some knock-on effects. I'm not saying that there aren't any interactions at all. No, I think that's why we'll just keep it.
I'm not talking about regulatory capital per se and how that's defined. But if you just take the example of 2007 with the rights issue, or 2008, where following the financial crisis, all banks have been asked to increase their capital, and you have a bank that just puts out an offer to all their shareholders in different markets and say, hey, you can sign up for new shares. And just because we do have a requirement that if this is not fixed in your own currency, this is a liability, that gives rise to both classification and measurement issues. And that, to me, is counterintuitive to what the primary effect should have been, really. That is an increase in capital.
Obviously, the discussion paper is going to be designed to draw out some of these issues, but I think where the board had a discussion on this particular issue, so thinking about the rights issue exception that's in 32 today, what we've been trying to do is keep as close to the principles that we've developed in the project as we can and make as few exceptions as we can, because I think one of the challenges we've found with 32 is because it's a sort of hodgepodge of good ideas as we came along. That's part of what's made it hard to deal with. So I think what we're trying to do wherever we can is stick with this initial idea. Then there are some consequences of that, which you're raising, and that's what we want to get feedback on. But I think, yeah, we're certainly aware of those interactions. On here?
Okay. I have some general comments and some specific comments. I used to members view that ISB should further elaborate on the examples and provide additional explanation on how the gamma approach is applied. And additional content for the examples could include journal entries over a particular period of time, especially where the fair value movements of some instruments classified as a liability are presented in OCR. And in addition, some members thought more complex examples should be included in the DP. And members also noted that the DG should clearly illustrate the difference between IS-32 and the gamma approach, and showing how the gamma approach solves perceived problems with IS-32 for each example presented. And they also pointed out that the DP should include a section on the implication of the FICE project proposals on the conceptual frame, particularly with regard to the increased use of OCI under the FICE presentation, interaction with the definition of liability. And members wanted to ask to explain how the principles applied in FICE tie back to the conceptual framework, because members are concerned that principles in FICE project could, in some cases, not be consistent with the conceptual framework. And for some specific specific comments regarding the definition of independent. A member noted that there could be a case in which it is difficult to identify whether a return is independent of the entity's economic resources. For example, if a return is derived from an entity's 1% of net profit, would it be considered dependent on the entity's economic resources? So this member asked for more clarification on the criterion of independence of the entity's economic resources. And another comment is about addressing issues submitted to IFRIC before. A member said that the DP would be able to show how the FIES project improved completeness, consistency, and clarity of the requirements by showing how Gamma Approach solves the issues that have been submitted to the IFRIC before, but have not been solved. For example, it could address the case of NCI put option issues that have been submitted to the IFRIC several times. My final comment is about foreign currency rights issue exception. It seems that the exception for the foreign currency rights issue in ISO 82 is removed in the DP. And so in contrast, the exception for putable instrument in ISO 82 would remain in the DP. And the ISP noted two reasons why it decided to maintain putable instrument exceptions, as explained in paragraph 30 of Agenda Paper 5A for February board meeting. And I note that one reason is that the ISP is not aware of any issue with the application of the putable instrument exception. And the other reason is that applying the Gamma Approach to instruments that meet the exception might address some of, but not all of, the previous concerns which led to exception. So I think that if I apply the reasons to the exception for the foreign currency right issues, I think we can say that ISP is aware of any issue with the application of the foreign currency right issue exception, and applying the Gamma Approach to instruments that meet the foreign currency right exception would address all of the previous concerns which led to the exception. So I wonder if I can say the two reasons are not valid for the foreign currency right issue exception, and that's why the ISP decided not to maintain the exception as opposed to the putable instrument exception. That's my question.
Sorry, your question, Wanhee, just to clarify. Are you asking whether the reasons that apply for the putable exception do not also apply for the rights issue exception?
Firstly, I wonder why the ISP decided to remove the exception for foreign currency rights issues. And I also wonder whether the same reasoning is applied to removing the foreign currency rights issues, which you used for the making putable instrument remain in the ISO 32.
Okay, so just on the putable exception in ISO 32, just quickly. I think one of the problems, or one of the constraints that accounting has, comes from mixed measurement and partial recognition. And you need to ultimately have some claim that's measured as a result of other direct measurements of assets, liabilities, and other claims. If everything is classified as a liability, then something needs to absorb some of those the results of mixed measurement and partial recognition. So you could still, I guess, define the instruments that would meet the exception as liability, but the measurement would have to be as if they were equity anyway, because something needs to absorb those effects. Something needs to be measured as a residual. That's the reason that's not addressed by the Gamma Approach, because it's just a fundamental constraint of financial reporting. And that's not that's different to the rationale for removing the FX rights issues. The problem, I think, as explained in sort of in slide 7, the situation today is that you could have identical FX derivatives on own equity, and some of them would meet the rights issue exception, some wouldn't. And so some of them would be classified as liabilities and some would be classified as equity. One of the main problems about classifying these instruments as liabilities is you get the effects of changes in own equity going through profit or loss. And so what the gamma approach does it tries to address that concern through separate presentation. And so we separately present some of those changes. And by addressing that point, it alleviates some of the need to have the rights issue exception. We're able to apply the classification of similar types of liabilities consistently and apply the separate presentation requirements consistently to some extent. To a greater extent than what is the situation under IAS 32 today. So I think there's different concerns that gave rise to each of those exceptions. The gamma approach addresses some of the concerns with the FX rights issue, and it doesn't address some of the other concerns with the probable exception.
Just to address some of your other questions, Winnie, absolutely fair. The board paper manual was talking about, we'll talk about the CF tieback conceptual framework and how it works. We are also your point you made about independent, fully aware, the question you raised, 1% of net profits, we have already discussed that. We will cover that when we go to that in the DP in something. And yes, certainly one of the objectives of the FICE project is to make sure we have answered as many as possible the problems that have come up, because that's one of the objectives which the board started with 32. And we have done that, we have kept a track. It will be how we have addressed these problems under gamma, because we can't use a DP to do an interpretation of 32. But certainly we are cognizant and we will take that through as we go through the DP. It will be there.
Alexandra?
FICC has a hot history in Brazil. A few companies have their financials reissued because of those instruments. So we've introduced experience there. And one thing that at the end of the day was very important is that sometimes we are standard setters are looking for the true definition of equity, the right definition of. And one point that was very important there was the presentation. So there's strong emphasis here on the presentation, because we even if people disagree, and sometimes they disagree because they are using equity or liability definition for different purposes. For example, they're calculating a debt to equity ratio. For a short-term instrument, well, maybe one definition of equity, it's okay. But then if you're using the same debt-to-equity definition for a perpetual bond, then the definition of equity, which is important, is another definition of equity, would be closer to ordinary shares, for example. So I believe this part of disclosure here should be, so people should be able to understand the critical elements that made the company decide to go one direction or other direction, and if they want to reclassify and use it differently. And second point is your fourth example here is exactly the example that gave so much trouble, because companies have a right to defer payment. It was a perpetual bond, exactly as you said here, pay 5% a year, and they have the right to defer payments until the moment they pay dividends. You say, well, you may not pay dividends in the future, but it's very unlikely that a company will exist listed in an equity market without paying dividends. So it's exactly the abuse of this ability to defer something infinitely, which it was conditioned to some, and say, well, but this is economic compulsion, which is something that I understand that you are not using the economic compulsion argument, but in that case, that instrument would be classified as a liability, if I understand you correctly. Okay, so if even if you have this right to defer the payment for the foreseeable future,
it accumulates and the return is. I think the point about that second feature is really about the payoffs. The payoffs to the returns to investors, and investors want to see the difference in the payoffs, that this type of instrument pays off exactly the same as...
Have you thought about what is the point of accumulating something that they're not going to pay?
Well, they will eventually pay it.
Yeah, if you're accumulating something, because they're going to pay it.
Which is, I believe, it's the main element. What's the point of accumulating this and say, well, I'm just accumulating for the sake of accumulation? To have
but I guess the point is to, what we're trying to do is identify another feature, which is the payoff, that is not dependent on whether something is actually going to be paid or... I mean, make no mistake, these things, they pay coupons on these things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
People pay dividends as well.
Yeah, of course. But they say something pay dividends, or pay dividends above 5% threshold, so something obvious.
So we've tried to identify another feature that focuses, instead of the obligation to sort of transfer something, that focuses on how the payoffs are different, and that's what we've tried to...
So summarizing, strong support for the document, just a little bit more on disclosure, I believe.
So I think that you hit on a very important point, which is the fact that this proposed treatment of the cumulative preference shares, we think, takes a lot of pressure off the economic compulsion argument.
Yes.
But it will be where we have an interesting debate with the banks, I'm sure, because they'll see loss absorption capacity in these instruments. So it will be interesting.
People use the economic compulsion argument to say, well, I don't have to pay.
Yeah. That's loss absorption.
Yeah, don't have to pay.
Linda.
So this discussion reminds me of the board meeting discussion we had on this topic, because it seems like as soon as you get started on this, everybody has their pet thing. Our board discussed this, I guess, a week and a half ago, and the one concern they had was, it seems like you're making incremental changes, and there's still the feeling that there is big change needed. So I think it's very important from a communication perspective that you explain what your principles are and how you chose your scope and that sort of thing, because the reaction to the examples that we got from our board was that, why are they picking these and why aren't they doing these? So, understand that. They think that's important. They also think that there's a fair amount of complexity in the example. There's concerns about both what users and preparers will deal, how they will deal with these, this level of complexity, as opposed to an overhaul. Now, are you going to go through the example?
Yes, we are.
I'll stay there. But communication of what it is you're trying to achieve now and your scoping is critical. Otherwise, I think what you're going to do is you're going to get a lot of people saying, why aren't you doing this or why aren't you doing that?
And that's one of our challenges, I think, because in one sense we're saying we're not turning the world upside down, but then we are making some important clarifications and trying to get the messaging between those two things is critical. Yukio.
Thank you. The Gamma approach distinguishes liability from equity, just combining two approaches, alpha approach and beta approach. The Gamma approach seems to be very complicated and retrogressive to simplification of accounting standards of financial instruments. In addition, it seems to self-justify the classification and IAS 32, and lack theoretical background. As such, we have concerns with this combined approach. Claim that to only meet the definition of liability and the alpha approach are totally different from claim that to only meet the definition of liability and the beta approach. So if we classify both types of claims as liabilities, it would be difficult to understand the distinction between liability and equity. Separately, presenting these types of liabilities within a liability section is of little help. Considering the discussion so far and slide 13, income or expense arising from liabilities, which meets the definition of liabilities and alpha or beta approaches, but not both, would be presented in OCI with no recycling. Neither the existing conceptual framework nor the forthcoming revised conceptual framework defines profit or loss. And we'd like to ask the ISD how the use of OCI and the decision not to recycle this item can be justified. We think profit or loss need to be defined. And based on our views of definition, it would be difficult to justify the use of OCI as proposed. And distinction between liabilities and equity is fundamentally important in distinguishing between items that are recognized as income or expenses and those that are not. The definition of income and expense refers to equity participants, and we think an appropriate distinction between liability and equity cannot be made without identifying who the owners are.
Thank you. Chris. So just a couple of general observations. Certainly agree. I think it's communication about what you're actually trying to achieve. And just as a general comment, if you're going to put out examples, I think you really need to tie them in very precisely to what your components of the gamma approach are. Like, I found it quite difficult with these examples to actually say which particular element of gamma were you using.
Yeah.
And I actually made my team go away and do that.
So
I think if you're trying to communicate, I think you clearly know where your end game is, but you need to take people on the journey. And then the second comment was that the concern is around they really don't understand where the differences are, and they didn't feel that these examples were drawing out where the differences might be. So I think you need to choose your examples very carefully, and I think you've heard enough of that from the rest of the group, but they were particularly interested in where settlement options are at the discretion of the issuer. So I think if you can start to highlight some of those where you think there is really going to be a difference, that's what they're actually looking for.
Compared to 32, Chris.
Yeah.
Okay.
And is it going to fix the IFRIC type issues, et cetera?
So why do we think it's fixed?
Yeah.
I'm Mary.
Sorry,
Chris, are you?
You were finished, Chris? And I just think, so the last thing for me was you sort of talked about there were a couple of objectives of the project. So why obligations to deliver a variable number of shares should be liabilities and why put options should be grossed up. And that might be discussed more in the DP, but I didn't think your examples actually pulled out those pieces of information as well. And ideally, I think it should all come together.
I think what we've tried to do in here is just show what the consequences are going to be instead of going through the underlying rationale. I think we discussed the underlying rationale quite a bit in December. It's very hard, I think, in here because there's so many interconnected parts to do it in just a single session, and that's why I think let's wait until the discussion paper where we bring it all together, where we can join all the pieces together and so you can have a look at
that. I think it's good advice because people are going to understand the discussion paper better if they can see how the principles link
to
examples.
Yeah.
It'll help us in our explanation. So yeah.
I think one of the key messages that I'm getting is with the examples, link it to which part of gamma makes you go there instead of just giving the example.
Correct.
What's driving that decision?
Mary.
And I'm going back to Juan, his comments, although the discussion we just had may answer this, but Juan, you were saying that some members wanted more complex examples, that they thought the existing examples were simpler. And Linda, I almost thought that you were perhaps going in the opposite direction. I wondered if Juan, his comment was actually answered by more analysis, this idea of better analysis versus the two legs of gamma, maybe more complete analysis versus more complex fact patterns, or if we just are getting different messages from different people bringing different issues. Linda, I didn't hear you saying
no,
dumb it, simplify
no,
it.
No, I'm not saying that at all, and I can examples, but I think the reality is everybody's going to go in there looking for their problem.
Yep.
Exactly. They're not going to see their problem necessarily exactly there. Mm-hmm. So when you pick, it's, I think, the same notion that Chris is saying. Pick your examples carefully. One thing I'm going to suggest you do is, if you build out an example, you need to consider a big issue for us is the terms change over time. So you need a phase one, a phase two, and a phase, like when this happens with the instrument, here's what the accounting is, and then the next year when the terms change, whatever. So I'm not saying make it simply. What I'm saying is you've got to communicate, you've chosen to do this much. Why? Because the first reaction I got from the board, and I have some very knowledgeable people on my board in this topic, was how come they're seeing an arbitrariness in what they saw in this paper, and I don't think it's arbitrary. They said, well, they're just tinkering with things versus saying a principle. I don't think that's what you're doing, but that was their perception. That really was the point that I was trying to make. Then we can talk about the examples.
It's probably partly the consequence of the slide deck.
And that's fine. Yeah.
My take on this question of whether we need simpler examples or more complex examples. The objectives of the project include addressing practical matters that arise from IAS 32 and addressing known areas of diversity in practice. I don't think these, under IAS 32, I think I know the answer pretty clearly for these four examples. So to demonstrate the project is likely to achieve those objectives, I think you need to pick some examples where there is diversity in practice or give rise to practical challenges under 32.
I think we have covered them with the board, and we're going to include some of those examples in the discussion paper. I saw the purpose of this was just to show where there's going to be potentially a change, as opposed to looking at, for instance, where some application guidance might help people come to better conclusions. And
but I think the point's well made. Also, I think Andreas made the point at the IFAS meeting that sort of going back through the old interpretation committee outcomes and where things weren't resolved, linking it back to completeness, I think
that's a good idea.
Okay, now, conscious of time, so we should move on to... Oh, sorry. Russ.
I was just going to say there's been some academic research in the U.S. that shows that there is a bias by the user of examples to find the one fact pattern in the example that's most relevant to their fact pattern and use that. So to Chris's point, we at the FASB have started to try to write examples that help the consumer of that understand the judgment inherent in the example, which I think is Chris's point, which is walk through the key steps someone has to think about to explain. I think that would go a long way for the user of the example. And I'd be happy to find that research and share it.
That
would be great.
Because if we do a good job of that, you would hope that people can then take their instrument and understand how to think through
the process.
Same thing which Linda was
talking about.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
They won't find exactly their example, but they should get the principles that will help them with their example.
That's okay, so Manuel, the example.
Okay, so example one. So example one is a derivative contract to receive a fixed amount of foreign currency in exchange for delivering a fixed number of equity instruments. The situation today is that some would be classified as equity and some would be classified as liabilities, depending on whether the contract meets the foreign currency rights issue exception. Under the approach to that's going to be included in the discussion paper, the gamma approach, they would all be classified as liabilities. However, they would be able to apply separate presentation requirements under certain circumstances. For instance, if there isn't any leverage in the foreign currency, the only variable other than the share price is foreign currency, and there's some other restriction on the entity issuing this instrument in its functional currency. This would also apply not only to standalone options, it would also apply to foreign currency convertible bonds, and so it would apply more consistently than the existing requirements. So that's one of the practical consequences of the model that we think would happen as compared to IS32 today. So there would be some change in both the classification and the separate presentation requirements for these instruments. So I just wanted to have any thoughts or comments on that specific example.
But in this case here, it wasn't local currency, but the derivative approach.
Sorry?
Not the derivative.
If it was a functional currency, if it was fixed for fixed in the functional currency,
okay.
Then it would
so
be...
fixed in the functional currency.
Yeah.
Then it would be equity. Yeah.
Fixed
for fixed functional currency. Thanks. I understand the example, I guess, in the context of IS32, a couple of things that I had was, you know, are we starting from where the conceptual framework effectively was going to include a reference to say that, you know, obligations settled in your own shares, you know, well, they're not your own resources, so that they wouldn't be liabilities, they would be equity, and I understand the conceptual framework, we've decided not to include that. But I was just wondering, you know, are we going to acknowledge that point around whether or not settlement in one's own shares is a liability or not? Or are we just being silent and starting where IS32 already is, which already has this concept that if it's fixed for fixed in your functional currency, well, that is equity. I'm not quite sure where the starting point is here.
Okay, so what when we talked about derivatives, the board talked quite a bit about how to apply the basic approach that's illustrated in the appendix to this to derivatives. One of the problems with derivatives is the unit of account, because derivatives are an exchange type of contract. You've got two legs.
Yeah.
So you're either going to classify all derivatives as assets or liabilities.
Yeah.
You're going to componentize liabilities, or you're going to come to some kind of classification decision based on the derivative in its entirety.
Mm-hmm.
The board decided to come to a classification decision on based on the unit of account of the derivative in its entirety. Now, because there's two legs, what it decided was that there cannot be any other variable in that derivative that's not solely dependent on the residual amount, which is tantamount to saying, you know, the only change is going to arise from the change in the share price. So what happens with the foreign currency issue is that there's an additional exposure in that derivative. There's an additional variable. That's the foreign currency. And
independent of the...
Yeah, which is going to be changing independent of the residual amount. And so that's what triggers the classification as a liability. Now, if you go down this classification process for derivatives, there's going to be a trade-off, naturally. Unless you're componentizing everything, there's going to be a trade-off. There's going to be some exposures that you're going to get. You're either going to get within equity that you don't want. For instance, if this was classified as equity, it would not be remeasured. You wouldn't get any information about foreign currency exposure. Or if it's classified as a liability, you get some of the changes in the own share price going through P&L. We've tried to address that problem through the separate presentation requirements.
And just when you say separate presentation, is that presenting the change in the measurement in OCI?
Yeah.
And that would be the entire change.
Yeah.
So
either
P&L or OCI. The board has made
So it's not. So when you say separate, it's not necessarily going to be an OCI.
Well, eventually the board will have to go through.
So it could be P&L or OCI memory.
Yes.
Both will be covered in the discussion paper?
Yes. Both will be covered in the discussion paper, yeah.
Just a clarification on what you both said, the decision about separate presentation either in OCI or P&L is, I think, something that we expect the board ultimately to make a decision that the separate presentation will be either
yes.
X or Y. It's not going to be a choice or instrument
yes.
by
yes.
instrument.
Yes.
Or,
yeah.
Sorry.
No,
the point,
no,
I, was, the point
yeah.
I was trying to make is that the discussion paper will
cover both.
Suggest either alternative.
Yes.
Either it could be in profit and loss
or
it could be in OCI, and ask people to give us feedback on that
okay.
for a subsequent decision on location.
Okay. But I think then picking up on some of the comments that were made under the general discussion is I've been perhaps struggled to see how the gamma approach applies, because here the entity is delivering a fixed number of its own shares.
Yes.
So when I was getting to the, to again, I'm looking at slide 12 on the approach.
It's the concept of being independent of the entity.
But it's obligations for a specified amount. Now, my obligation is to deliver 100 shares. That's my obligation.
That's right. And if you didn't have the foreign currency exposure in there, it would be classified as equity. It's because
the price was functional currency.
But what I'm saying, but based on the words here, I still perhaps struggle to understand how just because what I'm receiving.
Because we're classifying the derivative as a whole, so we include the receipt leg in that analysis as well. And because that is independent of the entity, then that the whole, because we're classifying the whole instrument, Kim. We're not if we're for instance componentizing, which we're not doing, you would separate that out, and that would be an equity component, and then there'd be some kind of asset component or something. But we're not going
to
do that.
So this shows us we need to be very careful to illustrate how it ties.
That's exactly right.
Well, that's the yep. point. So I mean, I'm saying I'm not uncomfortable yep. with the end answer.
Trying to tie back to the words.
That's yep. right. It's yep. just that when you then say, okay, well, I've got yep. the yep. words in this yep. approach. How do we actually get to the answer? So I think at the moment it just says classify both consistently as liabilities, but it's not really clear. Yep. How did we actually get to the liability?
Yeah, yeah.
So I think
there's a lot of additional analysis that goes into classification, a lot of process that goes into classification of derivatives, which we haven't included in this slide deck. We're just presenting the outcome.
So that's helpful. So that's something we'll need to go in the document.
Yes, of course we'll do that.
Otherwise, I think, again, people are going to go, oh, well, don't really understand how this gets passed together, et cetera.
Fair comment. Andrew.
Yeah, thanks. So if I understand the proposed change here, we're getting away from the fixed-for-fixed rule to a concept based around whether the amount of the derivative depends solely on the residual.
Yep.
In the fixed-for-fixed rule, I think I more or less understand it. I think there have been questions on things like anti-dilution provisions, yes. and practices sort of coalesced to get to a sensible landing on those. So I'm not trying to defend the fixed-for-fixed rule, but I think I do know what to look at, which is both legs of the derivative. Not entirely sure I understand yet all the elaborations or follow-on questions that come from these words about dependency on the residual, entirely dependent. This even simple local currency fixed for fixed exchange contract might have time value and credit risk components, which are not linked to the residual, for example. The amount of the derivative, is that its fair value? Its fair value at inception, throughout its life until maturity? Just questions. And I think the basic building block needs to be elaborated further before I can say whether this example properly illustrates what the board has in mind. I don't know whether it would make a difference, again, getting away from the foreign currency aspect, whether this was net settled, net share settled, net cash settled, or has to be gross settled to be equity, for example. So, the question is, does this example illustrate the application? I think up to a point would be my thing to go further.
Andreas.
Just a point on this question. The fixed for fixed was maintained.
Pardon?
The fixed for fixed criteria was maintained in this proposal. That was my understanding.
The outcomes are the same, but the articulation is different.
Okay, but the outcomes are the same. So.
Yeah. Broadly speaking.
It's different.
Andrew's right, and I think Manuel alluded to more application guidance, and I think this is a particular area where we propose to be, we'd need to hum quite a few bars to explain what this independent of means in the context, particularly of derivatives, which are more complicated. But the sort of basic idea is the same. Andreas.
I said before, this example concerns me greatly, I must say. Not because I don't understand the logic. I think I understand the logic of the model. I just feel that people will object to it because they say, our model is so good, we don't need reality. Yeah. So if I'm an entity that wants to increase capital, And just as a courtesy, I don't force anybody, any shareholder, to go through my local currency, but I'm offering that through different currencies. To say that this rights issue is now classified as liability, I think for me, is economically nonsensical. It stays within the model, I understand that, but I think it will give rise to enormous discussions about what's reality, what's economic reality, and does it faithfully portray what's going on. And I think you have to be really cognizant about this thing. And I don't see anything, I must say, that has caused me to change the board's logic when approving the rights issue in the first place that now has changed in terms of acknowledging that economic reality. So I think you really, in the paper, I would appreciate if you could hammer out as to why you believe that this example is not only flowing with from the principle that you set out, but also why you believe it meets quote-unquote economic reality.
And
which
why?
Is, I think, the bigger big challenge, really.
And why we think it provides more useful information, because I think that's where the board was coming from. But that's a fair point. I'm Mary. I'm conscious of time, because we've only got half an hour and three more examples.
It's a quick point, but I think it's on the communication, both the lesson for us and maybe something asking the people here to be the first messengers. And it's exactly Alessandro's question about, I thought you were keeping fix for fix. A lot of this project is about taking something that today is expressed as a rule, there is a fix-for-fix rule, and trying to explain the principles that underpin it. So you're right, Alessandro, the fix-for-fix rule isn't disappointing, disappearing, but rather than sitting there just as a rule, it's going to have the principle underpin it. So I think that's part of what explains the beta leg of the gamma approach, the independent. So I think if we all try to communicate about it that way, it in some ways that's a really good example of what the scope and objective of this project is, to take something that exists today, not just throw it out, but say what's the principle underpinning so we have better ideas of its limits.
My experience is a little bit different from Andreas, because in my case, the fix was fixed at something very easy to explain. Because when it's fixed for fixed, it's very easy to understand. It's like a subscription. Mm-hmm. When it's variable, you're using your own currency, your own shares as currency. Yeah. Because it can be anything. So.
But it is where we get.
That's why you help it to.
Yeah.
But it is where we get a lot of questions and confusion. Yeah. So
that
I think
the cut off.
In terms of being responsive to where 32 has been tricky. Mm-hmm. I think this is a very good example.
And whether it's kind of like a bright line or for instance, if there's some changes as a result of anti-dilution or
the points Andrew mentions,
or anything like that, whether they're still consistent with the underlying principle or just because you apply fix for fix, it just...
So under that philosophy, that this is a clear articulation of what exists today, would you say example one is practiced today?
Is
practice. I mean, what Mary Tokar is saying is that what this is a better articulation of an existing rule.
Yes, this
so
would be liability classified today.
So
absent the rights issue exception.
Absent the rights issue.
Absent the rights issue exception.
That's right.
So your point is while this is consistent with practice, you disagree with the outcome?
Well, this is consistent with practice. Well, it changes practice.
Well, if it changes practice, how can the principle...
that's
my point.
Because of, on that slide, the fixed foreign... the foreign currency rights issue exception, which exists today, is the piece that is being taken out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's fixed for fixed. Is underpinned by a principle, but today we have a rule plus an exception, and what we're exploring is taking away the exception.
Yeah.
So as a
general
proposition, if you've got a foreign currency denominated derivative under 32, it's liability classified, unless you're in the scope of this narrow rights issue exception. So Andreas is referring to the exception. But the basic principle in 32 would be if it's foreign currency, strike price, liability classified.
So you disagree with taking away the exception?
Yes.
Yeah, for economic reasons.
Right.
So we're on notice, we need a good argument, otherwise Andreas is...
So I'm going to take example 2 and 3 together.
So example two is the share redeemable for fair value, and example three is the written put option for a fixed strike price. The difference between the examples is that, apart from the being example two being puttable at fair value, example two is a non-derivative, so you're looking at the instrument as a whole, whereas example three, there's a standalone written put option that's been issued. However, under both, there are similar outcomes. There's a potential liability settlement outcome because both might require a cash payment, but also that under both, there's still sort of some equity relationship because of the changes in the fair value of the share price, and also for the written put option example, the counterparty has the option to continue to hold the shares. I should also mention that the example two, it's an example of an instrument that does not meet the puttable exception under IS 32 today, and so under IS 32 would be classified as a liability. So the situation today, for example, two would be classified as a liability, and changes in the value of the liability would be income and expenses. Under the approach that we're going to be including in the discussion paper, that classification would continue as a liability, but the practical consequence would be separate presentation of the changes. And that's the additional bit that's going to change. If we come across to the written put options example, so at the moment under IS 32, what is clear is that it requires the gross up of the redemption amount. However, there are a lot of questions that have come to IFRIC about how to do the accounting, where the corresponding debit goes to, which component of equity, how to derecognize things. There are also questions about subsequent measurement. If, for instance, it wasn't a put option for a fixed amount, if it was a put option for fair value, how to account for the subsequent measurement of that redemption amount as a liability. So there are all these questions about written put options accounting. So under the approach to be included in the discussion paper, we're still going to maintain the redemption obligation amount, but we're going to clarify some of the questions about subsequent measurement, that changes in the liability or income and expense. If it's for a fixed amount, those changes will be presented just like any other interest changes. If it was for the fair value of the share, similar to the shares redeemable at fair value, those changes would be separately presented, and so we'd get a consistent approach to both of these examples. The board did consider some additional guidance in the February board meeting about what to do when a written put option is issued within equity, whether to de-recognize the share. So there's going to be additional clarifications in the discussion paper about how to do the accounting within equity and the consequences of the written put. But that's not illustrated here today. So any questions or comments on examples two and three?
Andreas.
I wasn't quite sure as to your last point. When I do have a written put option, do I reclassify equity, the equity shares, and then measure the resulting liability, or do I record an extra liability for the written put? Because I think, economically speaking, I don't see a big difference between example two and three.
Exactly.
Where under two, you're actually reclassifying the shares and measure them, and example three, I think, should give you the same result.
And that's what the board discussed last month, and yeah, that will be the outcome. Okay. Mm. We just haven't illustrated that here.
Okay,
so
fine.
Just yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That was what was the discussion.
Andrew.
It's a drafting point. Example two, I got a bit confused by the 32 analysis saying it's referring to unless they meet the puttables exception, but we're told on the fat person they don't meet the puttables exception. I think it would be helpful if we're for both the redeemable shares and the written puts, making a contrast between like a fixed redemption amount and a fair value to illustrate that for both fact patterns, if you like, to get the point across. I also think, in my experience, there are many situations where the redemption amount is based on a valuation of some sort that might not be, if you like, an IFRS 13 fair value. So I'm not quite sure that's something you're going to be looking at in due course, and which side of the line those sorts of variations on pure fair value reform.
Thanks.
Oh, Chris. So I think we had some mixed views from our panel. So some of them actually saw example three as having similar sort of outcomes to own credit risk. So they were sort of going, why couldn't you get the OCI treatment for that? So I just think you might just need to be a bit careful how you're actually explaining why you don't get it for three.
Any other comments? No?
There is a separate presentation in equity, OCR.
If it was at fair value,
yeah.
It was puttable at fair value, but if it's for a fixed amount, then similar to just a liability for a fixed amount, you'd do the amortized cost thing, unless you take the fair value option and then you do whatever measurement and...
I'm missing the own credit point, though, because the own credit point came from fair value measurement of the liability.
What they were just sort of looking at is that if you're doing better, they were seeing this as meaning that the value of the shares that you were giving up, even though it was still just $100, was actually moving. So I think there was just a bit of a flaw in their logic. So
I think what we'll try to do in the discussion paper is, and what we had at the February meeting was some debits and credits, just to illustrate some of those movements and where they go. So I think that might help a bit in explaining things. So example four, the non-redeemable cumulative preference shares. Now this example probably represents the main kind of area where there's potentially a classification change if we sort of follow the logic of the underlying rationale. Based on the approach that's going to be included in the discussion paper. At the moment today, under IAS 32, these instruments will be classified as equity because the entity has the unconditional right to avoid transferring cash or another financial asset. However, this is just a contrasting statement to the example, if the obligation did require settlement by transferring a variable number of shares at some point, then it would be a liability, even though similarly it does not require the transfer of economic resources. So it's about this, the point about the whether it's the transfer of shares that creates the liability, or whether it's because the amount of the claim, the payoffs of the claim, are similar to a debt instrument that we're trying to get to the bottom of. So under the approach to be included in the discussion paper, all obligations for a specified amount independent of the entity's resources will be classified as a liability, regardless of whether they're settled in shares, whether the entity can defer paying cash, so long as the amount of the claim at any particular point in time is a specified amount. There would be separate presentation in a statement of financial position to give users information that these have a very different liquidity profile to some of the other claims against the entity. And that would apply similarly to both these types of instruments and the instruments that might be settled with a variable number of shares. So just to indicate that there's not going to be a transfer of resource requirement as a result of these claims. Does anybody have any questions or comments on the example?
I did as well, but Linda?
So these are the notes I have in my staff, and we have the words big, prevalent issue in Canada. So this is the one I was supposed to emphasize. So I think it was, they weren't sure how much wine I was going to have last night. Okay. So what you're proposing would be a significant change in practice. And this is the one where in particular you have to look not just at transition, but you got to look down the pike at subsequent subsequent changes, because the change in the terms, they change over time, right? And they go from fixed rates to variable rates. And so you're also getting into the notion of the capital treatment today versus not. So we see this one as needing a lot of communication and in terms of the rationale. Okay? So, but big, big change. This is the one that stepped out and grabbed our attention.
Yep.
And your banks have these even though they're cumulative, because it's only into liquidation, so that's still okay for the...
It's for the capital. Yeah.
And...
You made some of the points already. I think I was confused about reconciling your comments about looking at the payoffs with what seems to be pulling in some claims into the liability definition where mandatory settlement is only upon liquidation. I think it'd be helpful, maybe not for the final discussion paper, but to consider variations on the fact pattern here. So I think this is a 6% cumulative preference share where interest actually compounds on the deferred payments. So I can see if 6% is the appropriate discount rate to apply, then mechanically you're going to get to 100% liability under this model. If the market rate was somewhat higher, or if there wasn't annual compounding, then you might be that there's an equity component represented economically by the hope that the holders of these preference shares actually hope to get their dividends on time. And if it was just a fixed claim on liquidation, then maybe again there'd be a liability component which might be discounted back to zero based on when you assume liquidation might happen. Lots of variations there. On the analysis under IAS 32, I think this reference to an obligation to transfer a variable number of shares is really confusing. I mean, that's you're introducing a variation in the fact pattern as part of the analysis, as I can see. And if I understand, there is no mandatory settlement prior to liquidation. So under 32, if there's no mandatory settlement of anything prior to liquidation, it's equity.
That was good.
I think that's the point, but I think it's going back to this question about, for instance, something that would be settled prior to liquidation could still be equity under 32, if it was, for instance, for a fixed number of shares. But if it's for a variable number of shares, it would not be equity under 32, it would be a liability.
This was going to be my question as well. Because
the fact pattern says that you don't have to pay anything prior to liquidation. So under 32...
No, but I think what we're trying to sort of get to, and I know I probably shouldn't have mentioned that.
Yeah.
In hindsight. Too late.
This question about settlement using the entity's own equity is a tricky one, because in some cases at the moment we treat it as equity, and in some cases we treat them as liabilities, depending on whether it's variable or a fixed number of shares.
But if it was only at liquidation, and it was either going to be $150 of cash or $150 worth of owned shares, but only on liquidation,
yes,
that would be equity under 32, right?
Yes, but I guess the question is,
is it this because
even under IAS 32, if it's still going to be settled by a fixed number of shares, it would be equity. So
I'm saying that your reference here to variable number of shares.
Yeah. And if it's variable only on liquidation,
that would still be equity.
What's the fact pattern is the question.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, the fact pattern is a non-redeemable cumulative preference share. Yes. Yeah.
So that's why I got confused with the however.
But the question is, the question we're trying to get to, if you're doing a classification under the gamma approach that's independent of the settlement outcome, and you're solely just looking at the payoffs, then would this change the classification of this type of instrument?
Yeah.
I think that's the point.
Anything else on example 4?
So I think what I'm taking away from the conversations we have in the discussion paper, when we're developing the example, we'll try and be quite careful in how we it's not so much picking the right examples, but it's how we present the process of walking through the examples and applying the approach and doing that quite carefully so that respondents can follow that and be able to apply that process to different types of instruments to see whether that works for them, for the instruments that they're going to care about, which may not be the instruments we use in the discussion paper.
Yes, methodology is very important.
It's the methodology, yeah.
Next day, people start to invent new instruments.
Yes, of course, and that's always the risk of using examples in this space because they become quite stale quite quickly. So it is very much about the analysis that's required and providing people with the tools they need to come to the right conclusions.
I wonder whether another example that we should include in the document just for completeness would be something like a convertible bond just to show that the compound thinking is still retained.
So the examples that we took to the board in February, the convertible bond and the written put, which were quite comprehensive, we're going to include those examples in the discussion paper.
But I think we also need to give the reasoning why under gamma
exactly,
these things meet.
Yeah. Just make them comprehensive.
All of them.
Do the analysis, do the debits and credits, make it easy to follow.
And explain why it's useful information.
Linda, can I just a quick question? You mentioned something with the example four, the slight variation. What was the variation?
The terms change. They go from being fixed to variable.
Fixed to variable, right.
They're very creative instruments.
But they're not, sorry.
I didn't create them, okay?
But not variability due to share price.
There's variety. You actually have to look at the...
Yeah.
I mean, I can get one of my staff to...
Term sheets.
Yeah. Mary?
I think, Manuel, the disputed, however, bullet under example four was perhaps, I think, you trying to make the point about consistency versus inconsistency with economically similar instruments. And I think, as you just said, one of the messages we've heard is the need to spell out very carefully the application of the gamma approach, point taken. The question is, how useful do people think it is to try and say, here's, you know, kind of having done it this way, should we be trying to look at it this way in terms of saying, as a result, these things will line up and this is where the dividing line is? Because I think what we've learned is throwing it into the example is maybe not the way is a distraction, but should we still be trying to bring out the, therefore we get a greater degree of consistency across the following which we think are economically similar transactions? Because I think that's what you're trying to bring out. Does that help?
Russ?
I wanted to move on to slide
12.
Do you want to talk about example four?
Sorry, just to Mary's point.
No, I just want to say something about the summary you just made. Sorry to be insistent, but it's very important to have disclosure here.
Yes.
Very comprehensive in terms of disclosure.
Russ.
So I read slide 12 to say the philosophy of what you're getting to is that it has to be indexed to equity and has to be settled in equity. So that's what U.S. GAAP is, and it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work is because there are all these provisions that are the black swan event, highly unlikely. And when you make it on settlement and it's focused on control, you have these situations where, for example, in the U.S., if you have to settle it in equity and your equity has to be registered, it's a liability because you cannot assume there'll be sufficient equity that's registered. If your provision is that it's settled in equity, if you have a clean audit opinion, you can't control a clean audit opinion. So if you go down this approach, you might want to have some threshold in there or some philosophy that you think about realistic events, not unrealistic.
Yeah,
no. Otherwise, you're going to end up where we are, which doesn't work.
Thanks, Ross.
He's right.
It doesn't
work. Okay. But what what you need, Manuel?
I think so, yeah.
Have a good work. Yeah. Okay.